Now sit back with your favorite beverage, take a walk, or go for a drive while you enjoy today's episode of Marketing Unboxed, where we're taking the lid off of our marketing knowledge and generously sharing it with you. Hey there. I'm Travis L. Scott, and welcome to the very first inaugural episode of Marketing Unboxed. Very excited to kick this off and really dig into the world of marketing and share our knowledge. Today's episode is an interview with Michael F. Schein. He is the author of The Hype Handbook and is the president of Microfame Media in New York City. Today's episode, we talk mostly about his book, which really revolves around psychology and marketing and influence. So if those topics are of interest to you, you're going to really enjoy this one. Enjoy.
I am joined by Michael F. Schein, the author of The Hype Handbook and the president of Microfame Media. Welcome to the show, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Travis. Thank you for having me.
So yeah, I read your book and really enjoyed it. Learned a lot, and excited to chat today about the book, about kind of what you found out along the way, and how it's changed your business and life. And so I guess first off, if you read the book, I think one of the interesting things early on that you talked about. It was kind of a catalyst for, I think it kind of shined the light on using hype and using some of these techniques that people have used for, since the beginning of mankind, really, yeah. To persuade and create advantages. You talked about a spat with Gary Vaynerchuk. Gary V. How did that start, and what was the impact of that?
Well, I guess the context was that I had just gone on my own and become a freelance copywriter after about 8 years working in a very corporate position. And working in a corporate position was something I fell into. I never wanted to do it. I wanted to write fiction, and I played in bands. I mean, and I had sort of this way that I viewed myself as artistic and a little bit mischievous. And then I needed to make a living, and I fell into this career, and I worked hard and I started to do well there. But by the time I left, I had become kind of corporatized. I was starting a freelance writing practice. Business, which is what I did before it evolved into the agency that I own. And after that near decade, it almost didn't occur to me that I could be anything but what I had been for the last 8 years. So like when it was time to market and sell, it was capital M marketing, capital S selling. I learned about, I took sales seminars. I learned about splash pages. I learned about Google Analytics. I mean, this very like, tactical kind of stuff. Cause I thought that was what it was. And then, I wasn't succeeding with that. I wasn't getting new clients, and I was on the verge of folding up shop and getting a job. And then I just sort of remembered how I used to be. I mean, I was always that guy who, I like to get a rise out of people, and it was always effective for me. I mean, when I played in bands, we were the band that, always did a really mischievous thing. I was actually talking about how I played in this battle of the bands in high school, and we were terrible, but we got a really good reaction because we brought Slim Jims and handed them out to like the burner kids at school, and they started throwing them at the crowd and like hit a teacher in the head, and it wasn't us, but people talked about it, and we were the only band people could talk about. So like I sort of lost that side of myself, and I kind of got it intuitively. So yeah, I had nothing much to lose. And Gary Vaynerchuk was the biggest kind of digital marketing guru in the game. And I just kept hearing him talk about hustle, hustle, hustle. He just relentlessly was telling young people, screaming at them really, to work like dogs, and not just work hard. I mean, tweet from the toilet at 3 a.m. And it's just like, not that there's anything wrong with hard work. Everyone works hard if they're going to be successful, but I just didn't get why he was giving this advice with such passion. I mean, the people who follow Gary Vaynerchuk aren't lazy people. That's why they listen to Gary Vaynerchuk. So it occurred to me that maybe something else was at play and that Gary was helping Gary more than he was helping these kids. And when I did research into cults, it turns out that one of the best ways to form a bond with your cult members is to get them to work hard on your behalf, on behalf of a cause. I didn't know that at the time, but just something didn't sit right. And I also was selling packages of content. So it was structured packages. So the idea was that if you didn't have time and energy to create online content, use this service. So it was kind of the opposite of what Gary was preaching, do it yourself. So I wrote an article in Inc. where I had a column at the time. And basically it was called Why Gary Vaynerchuk is Flat Out Wrong. And I very politely, very, very politely, in fact, I think he's a good business person, I talked about why I disagreed with his ideas. And he responded that night with a video calling me out by name. And I was nobody. I was failing at the time, you know, and he was the biggest name of the guy on the scene. And all his followers started like berating me, and I was scared. And I was like, why did I do that? And then I got all these emails and tweets and messages from people all over the country telling me how much they appreciated what I had said and how they were thinking the same thing, but didn't mention it. And, you know, and before I knew it, I had this little clan around me. I had a following for the first time. So that just taught me a lesson that just because you learn to quote unquote market in a corporate setting doesn't necessarily mean that's the only or even the preferable way to get attention and get people emotional so that they'll buy from you.
Yeah. That's fascinating. So kind of poke the bear and you had no idea that it would turn around and people would respond positively.
I mean, I think on some level I did, only because I wouldn't have done it otherwise, mm-hmm. but it was like, I normally would have been too scared to do it. It's just that I had nothing to lose. I mean, I've my whole life been fascinated by people who attracted attention and got people emotional by being contrarian. Mm-hmm. And it's almost crazy that I hadn't thought of it sooner, because that had been my MO for my entire life, but I had become this kind of play it safe guy. So in some ways I was coming home, I guess.
Yeah. And you're kind of playing into kind of the heart of storytelling, right? With an antagonist and a protagonist.
Yeah.
And you have to have a common enemy more or mm-hmm. less. And for a subset of people, Gary V was your common, you know, enemy is a strong word, but in a story, you know, the bad guy. Yeah. And you had a group of people who could rally behind that. And he had his, and that's how he probably formed his group. I like Gary V. I think he's got some good messages out there.
He's great. Yeah.
I think a big target audience for him is, you know, really are young people just coming out of school or just getting started. And
no question.
And when I hear him talk, I know why he does it, but I hear kind of him doing that same thing, only the enemy, so to speak, the bad guy, bad girl, or really parents, you know, don't listen to your dad putting you down and things like that. He kind of
school, book learning.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, I mean, the guy's entire MO is adversarial, which works really well. I mean, there are a whole lot of quote unquote thought leaders or gurus out there, kind of gentle, kind and gentle, talking about things. And none of them are as big as him, because he just destroys. He brings down idols everywhere he goes. And yeah, all the people who follow him are young, and young people tend to be very black and white thinkers. And it's funny, all these big corporations hire VaynerMedia, not so much because they've seen his ad campaigns or digital ad campaigns, it's because they want some of that Gary V magic sprinkled on their company. They want that kind of fervent connection with people and their brands. And he's completely adversarial. Never disrespectful, though. He's not a troll.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a difference.
Definitely. But yeah, and I think kind of what you did and what Gary does is really a good example of one of, you know, some of the things you highlighted in your book. And so you did that. You started to get a following. Ideas started to come about, you know, how to look at marketing differently. I'm a marketer, and, you know, with a capital M, and focus on B2B and things like that. But there is something to hype. And, you know, as ideas started to come to you, what was the catalyst really for writing the book? What was the trigger?
I want to answer that, but first I want to comment, if it's okay, on something that you said before.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
There is a need for marketing with a capital M. You know, I mean, you need to understand how to best use technology. You need to understand the tactics, right? You can't just have an understanding of principles of mass psychology, which is how I define hype. I mean, hype to me means any set of activities that get a large number of people emotional so that they'll do what you want them to do. And a lot of times people, like, you know, people have been, like you said, using this stuff forever, but you need the marketing with the capital M. Where I think a lot of people go wrong is they forget why they're doing it. In other words, they reverse it. They start with the tools and tactics. So someone will be working in a large company and they'll say, I'm a marketer. And you dig in. And what that means is they really understand Google Analytics, and they really know how to set up landing pages, and they really understand how to Instagram. But when you talk to them about how many people with those tactics have you gotten to be fanatical about what you're selling, well, engagement and da 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 da, and they can't answer it because they have a job. You know what I mean? And they don't Absolutely. Need to do that, right? So those tools are vital. And in my company, I'm not particularly interested in that kind of tactical execution, but I work with people who are. You can't just scream from a mountaintop. But I think the deeper thing is that we are animals. We're human beings, and we're extremely social animals. And the tools and tactics change, but these core principles that when we get in groups get us worked up into a frenzy on behalf of a cause or a product. I mean, it could be Cabbage Patch Kids. It could be the Nazi Party. It could be the Civil Rights Movement. But the principles that get people worked up, if you strip the content out of it, are pretty similar, you know? And I guess that's what I'm saying. This is not an anti-capital M marketing book. It's that I think right. people get the order reversed. So anyway, Absolutely. I want to answer your first question, but I think that's really key. And yeah. that's why I call it hype
yeah.
instead Absolutely. Of marketing.
Yeah, and I think I used to be a marketer that led with the tactics and led with the tools and the shiny things, you know, and then until I realized how much psychology is involved, and I got back to realizing that we're dealing with people, and people have emotions, people have needs and wants. And even if it is B2B, their job could be at risk. Their job satisfaction could be affected.
Yeah.
They have to tell somebody, usually in a B2B setting, of, you know, they're not the lone person responsible for a purchase. They usually have to get other people involved and buy in. And so there is a lot of psychology involved.
So I guess that leads into your question of why I wrote the book. So the copywriting practice became a marketing agency because I got so good at getting people to get excited about my messages and you know, I expanded from that Gary Vaynerchuk thing and started really using this mischievous approach and getting people emotional and forming a following and getting them to buy from me. So companies started to want that as much or more so than the writing. The reason I wrote the book is because I would talk to prospects and clients and competitors and contemporaries, and they talked about marketing as if it was this disembodied thing, like it was like a discipline, like mechanical engineering, you know, or plumb or like hydraulics. Like it was all about, like you said, the tools and the tactics. But I didn't see any massive earth-shaking changes happening. You would have these hardcore marketing professionals, and I would say to myself, then why aren't people extremely fanatical about your products? Why aren't you setting the world on fire? And then I would think about the people who don't call themselves marketers, who are good at that. So I don't know, Madonna, she's not a marketer, but, you know, wasn't rolling around in a wedding gown during Like a Virgin marketing. I mean, there was before that MTV show and after that MTV show, and she's the biggest star in the world. I mean, there's, Richard Branson. You wouldn't call him a marketer. You know what I mean? But a hot air balloon ride across the Atlantic, you know, having fun baked into everything he does. A cult that gets people, that gets, you know, the Moonies, who get 1,000 people to do a mass wedding. Horrible stuff, but like, is, how do you do that? How do you get that many diverse people to commit to such a crazy thing? And I'm like, if I compare those people to marketers, quote unquote, who's better at it? Exactly. And so I said, well, why don't I look at those people? And as long as I can repurpose their concept ethically, because some of them are ethical people, some of them are horrible people. If it's, if I can find concepts that tie all that stuff together, I just felt that being a professional in this space, no one was saying that. Everyone was talking about, yeah, like I said, that capital M marketing. And I was like, well, you people are not a fraction as good as the non-marketers. So I needed another word for it. And that's, I reclaimed the word hype. Hype are those deep group psychology concepts that, whether you're using papyrus or holograms, that stuff is never going to change. And you need to master that stuff first. And that's the kind of stuff that, like, then you're not bouncing from thing to thing. Oh, I just learned Instagram and now Clubhouse is the thing. How frustrating is that? And I would just see that in our industry. And it just, I don't know, it bugged me. And the thing is, a lot of the people who aren't selling good stuff, the people who are selling scams and garbage and you know, all of this, they're naturally better at it. Because they don't let rules get in the way, you know? Exactly. And it bugged me that those people got these strategies and techniques so well. And the kind of well-meaning professionals just kind of were getting rolled over. So I wanted to even the playing field a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you make a point in the book about turning the table and helping people learn these things for good, to achieve good outcomes.
It matters a lot to me. I mean, I don't like seeing people get taken advantage of. It bothers me a lot for various reasons, you know, in my personal life. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you may not have a quick answer for this, but, you know, as you started to see these different techniques and study other people and steal like an artist.
Good book, by the way.
Love that book. Love that book. By Austin Kleon. Anyone that's interested, go check that out. I'm sure you looked at things people were doing, had some ideas, tried different things out. Was there something that you tried that you thought, man, this is going to work, and all of a sudden it failed miserably?
A lot of things. I mean, in the book, in the last chapter, I basically talk about how, or in the epilogue, really, I talk about how there are these core umbrella principles that you see repeated by quote unquote hype artists time and time again. But ultimately, experimentation is key, because general principles vary. The devil truly is in the details. The way you implement varies, and it varies from market to market. It varies from recipient to recipient. But once you crack the puzzle for your niche, you know what I mean? It usually rolls well for a while. So yeah, I did everything wrong. I mean, so then, based on that, I came up with a process. So, you know, I have an advantage and a flaw in that I never thought of myself as a business person. I was a writer, like a fiction writer, a player of music, you know, and like kind of an intellectual, not that I'm so smart, but that I like to read deep books and, you know, think about stuff and take notes. And I always have, even before this new reading trend. I used to be really nervous about letting people know I read, because I thought it would be make it harder to get girls when I was a teenager. I would like hide the book covers. I didn't want to be like a nerd, you know. Now it's suddenly cool. So what I would do is I would read all that I could read. When I finally figured out this is the way to approach things, I would steal like an artist, but then I would put a real world component. So I borrowed from Ryan Holiday this idea of like this common place book. So I had this kind of like big box, and I would like read everything from biographies of crazy cult leaders to offbeat business gurus to weird, obscure crowd psychology books. And I would take notes and I would find the themes. And it turned out there are like 12 themes of this crowd psychology that I call hype. But then fortunately I own an agency. So I would conduct small experiments based on what I learned. And it's true, book learning only goes so far. So I would be inspired by a theme in a book and I would try and experiment, and often it would just bomb, but I would always make the experiment small. And sometimes that would discount my hypotheses, even about what a hype principle was. You know what I mean? But then if something worked in the real world over and over again, then I'm like, okay, I can confidently tell you that this is not just book learning, that there's something here. So that's sort of what I've done. I have this feedback loop of like learning abstraction and then trying to apply it in a way that's a small enough investment of time or money that I'm not going to hurt myself by wasting months, by hurting a client's reputation, by whatever, all the going broke, you know, and that's sort of my process. And I think it's a good process in general.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's what I love about marketing. I think that's what attracted me to marketing, is the kind of the science behind it. Cause my undergrad degree was in science, and I think that way, and trying experiments, testing things out, having hypotheses.
Yeah.
You know, that's such a big part of marketing in general. As you test and learn about your market, your industry, everything's different. There's psychology at the base of it, right? That's the same, but how to communicate the right things at the right time to your audience is something that takes some testing and some practice.
It's completely psychology. And I think the scary thing or the exciting thing is that we're so predictable. Mm-hmm. In other words, like, we all think of ourselves as these total individuals, right? And what makes us individual is so much smaller than what makes us the same. So if we all behaved totally differently to stimuli, the kind of scientific marketing that you're talking about wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. Because I would put a stimulus in front of you and you would do one thing, and in front of someone else and they would do something else. But the fact is, with outliers, of course, the vast majority of people, the vast majority of the time, behave the same way, and they think they're doing it of their own free will, just based on how you change the stimulus. And that's weird and disheartening in some ways, but it's also true. And that's what allows this. It's because we're making decisions using our brains, mm-hmm. which are organs.
Yeah. Based on experiences, which we all have different experiences, but we all have a lot of very similar experiences.
Based on experiences, but through the filter of our brains, because our brains are designed to keep us alive and to get us to reproduce. So that means that we don't see the world accurately. So for example, large changes are very scary to people. Small changes are not, which is crazy. You can introduce the same stimulus in segments and get someone to do something. And if you introduce it all at once, they won't. And that's because big changes in nature are very dangerous. And that's a chapter in the book. I call it "Give the Babies Their Milk Before You Give Them Their Meat." And all hype artists do it. They get people to buy in by introducing things slowly. Very rarely will you see a new religion where they give you the supernatural gospel at the beginning. It's always, hey, you know, this is a healthy way to eat, or this is a way to fix your life, or this is a way to help with your drug problem, or this is, you know, it's always this small change. And before you know it, you're, you know, wearing different clothing and whatever, right? You've changed your entire life. But if you introduce that at the beginning, the same person would say, you're nuts. What do you mean a guy walked on water, right? Even if that's true. Mm-hmm. If you tell that to someone first, it's too different than what they're used to if they've never heard it before.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. You have to have anchors to get started.
Right.
And yeah, you mentioned, you know, that we're trying to protect ourselves and be safe and reproduce. And
we don't even know that's happening. I want to say,
yeah,
this is happening on a very subconscious level.
Exactly. And just it's always interesting how irrational people can be. When they think they're being completely rational. Yeah. And for example, my dad, my parents are out here visiting from Indiana. They drove an RV, my dad towed his motorcycle. And my dad has a lot of irrational fears. He won't go into the ocean, you know, deeper than his knees because he's afraid of sharks. he won't go hiking with me because he's afraid of bears. But yet he'll drive a motorcycle. And for me, I'm just like, exactly. I'm not going to touch the motorcycle because I know it's not a matter of if you wreck it, it's a matter of when. And I don't want any piece of that. And I'd rather go take my chances with a grizzly than a motorcycle in traffic with people on their phones. That's just me.
It's so true. I mean, we're all and we're all irrational, and there are some irrationalities that are, and this the irrationality is what makes hype work. So some people say to themselves, you know, I don't want to play on people's irrationality. That's not right, you know. And you say, well, is it not right? Because that's how people process the world. There's a reason for this irrationality. It's because at some point in our history, it helped us survive. In fact, it still does. Mm-hmm. Because we're bombarded with stimuli all day long. If you rationally interpreted everything, you would go crazy. Also, we're tribal creatures. So, I mean, look at the political situation. You can present facts to someone on either side and they'll discount it to cement their point of view. And you say to yourself, if you're on one side or the other, these people are idiots. Maybe, but is it more important to be right politically or to have a group identity that helps you get through the trials and tribulations of life, right? So you can either accept, you can either fight against that reality and pretend it doesn't exist. Or you can say, okay, look, people process information in an irrational way. I have messages or services or products or things that I think will help people. I'm going to frame my stuff in a way that these imperfect human brains, and I'm one of them. It's not like I'm looking down on everybody. I'm as irrational as everybody else. I'm going to frame this stuff in a way that they can digest this stuff. Mm-hmm. You have one of two options, but that's the truth. I mean, that's how we process information.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And who would you say your book is for? How would you describe your ideal reader of who needs to read it to get the most out of it?
You know, there were a lot of titles I could have used and a lot of descriptors for this type of mass persuasion or lowercase m marketing. And I used hype, and I was actually inspired by the world of hip hop because, you know, in hip hop, that's the one group where hype is considered a positive thing. Like for most people, hype is kind of like, you know, you're blowing a lot of smoke around something that's not good. But in hip hop, you always have like the hype man and hyping stuff up and hyping up the show. And I thought about why that was. And, you know, hip hop comes from the South Bronx, which is the poorest community in the United States of America. It was created by people who were so poor, they couldn't even afford drum kits and guitars. So they had to use turntables, and they made the dominant 21st century art form. And I think just there's this idea in hip hop that if you're disadvantaged, you can either curl up into a ball or you can use kind of the detritus of your world and hype stuff up, you know, use the reality of how the world is. And I thought that was a really cool metaphor. So I think if you're anyone who is in a situation where they either permanently or temporarily are losing the messaging battle, where they're disadvantaged in some way. So like I just did a talk for the NIH. They brought me in to talk, the National Institute of Health. Certainly not the equivalent of hip hop, but think about them. We're in a massive health crisis, the biggest in our lifetimes, maybe even our parents' and grandparents' lifetimes. And the preeminent health organization of the United States couldn't convince people to see the world their way. They've struggled at every step around masks or even around vaccines. And you had other people who shall remain nameless, who are insanely good at understanding the irrationalities of the human mind, who won the messaging war. So I think the NIH, you know, they didn't say this outright, but they were like, you know, we got to change the way we always lead with logic and studies and things like that. We got to get a guy in there who can teach us how to talk to people the way they really need to be talked to rather than pushing our facts down their throat. So I think whether it's a small startup entrepreneur who's struggling to get their message out, or a legacy business who for years controlled the conversation, but it's just getting rolled over by the new youngsters who understand the communication methods better. It's coming from that marginal position back into the center, taking back control of the conversation. So I think that's really what the book's about.
And I think it's a great book for even a broad audience, just out of just who are curious and like context and around history and life. And, you know, there was a lot that I had, you know, known about, but then the way you put it in perspective from hype and how they use these things and knowingly or not, and the psychology behind it, it made a lot of sense. And then as I was reading the book while I was in South Dakota visiting family and on vacation, and all of a sudden I started noticing it everywhere.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
that happens. Yeah.
I was watching a documentary on Mike Tyson, and you know, they're talking about Don King, and he was Mike Tyson's promoter, and
he's great with hype, like him or not. I mean, he's amazing. Yeah.
And as I was watching that, I was like, wow, he was really great at his job of being that was his job, promoter, right?
Promoter. He promoted very well
and did such a fantastic job. And I was just like, wow, like he got it and he used it and he didn't care what people thought because that was his job
at the smallest level. Right. So like there's a chapter in the book called Prayers, Spells, and Symbols. And it basically is the idea that we often discount the sort of easy to digest words, right? Like we have to explain things in detail and we're educated individuals, but human beings are very attracted to repetition. They're very attracted to things like rhyme and alliteration and things like that. And they're very attracted to phrases that you can put your own meaning into. And that's because people, it goes back to when we were babies. Learning language is a very complicated thing to do. And babies do that. And there's a lot of ways they do that. But one of the things is repetition and rhyme. All of these things come out of, you know, making it easier for us to learn language. So back to Don King, he did the Muhammad Ali fights, the Thriller in Manila, the Rumble in the Jungle. I mean, even that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, just the way he could have called it the African Championship Belt, you know, competition, right? But it was the Rumble in the Jungle. We still remember that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the same with Muhammad Ali, you know, and things that he did. He rhymed a lot and just made it easy to remember and visualize. So,
and sometimes we make fun of that stuff, right? Like we think it's less serious, like Johnny Cochran, when the OJ thing was going around, if the glove don't, or what was it? If the glove don't fit, you must have quit. And everyone made it out like he was a clown. That guy was no clown. He won.
Yeah.
And I mean, the guy is one of the most talented lawyers in the country. And I would say that if he had anyone else, OJ Simpson would have gone to the death row.
Yeah.
I mean, so clown or no clown, you know, we think we're too serious for this stuff, you know, it works.
And that was the most memorable part of the entire trial that everyone was fixated on. And that's what they remember most.
And as a result, you remember, the jury remembers that the glove didn't fit. Exactly. There was so much information. It wasn't about the phrase. It was about he made that piece of the evidence pop.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So there was reasonable doubt.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And the examples are everywhere. And that's what I thought was just fascinating about your book is how it kind of put that in perspective for me. And now I can see things that were always there. I just didn't see them through this lens. So yeah, it was a great book and really fascinating. And I think it does appeal to a wide range of people. And so starting to narrow down and niche down, your company, Microfame Media, you mentioned in LinkedIn that, you know, you're a marketing agency that turns consultants into celebrities. Are you focused just on consultants or other people?
No. And we're actually in a period of transition. It's been a fun and exciting time for the company because, the reason we started with consultants wasn't because that these strategies only apply to consultants. It's because consultants you know, companies and people selling ideas rather than like hardcore products, they get that they need this. They understand that their financial success, once you go above and beyond being good at what you do, competent at what you do, is a direct function of being known for like one thing in a niche and being more well-known than everyone else, getting that energy and that sort of visibility around what you do. So we just knew that they needed it, and they knew they needed it. And so that became where we started. We expanded out beyond that as an agency. I mean, a lot of work with a lot of tech companies that have idea-based businesses, but it's funny. While that agency sees that line of business is still alive and kicking and will always do that, the book has, I am so grateful for this, has gotten a lot of buzz, you know? And so as a result, I've talked to a lot of people and realized that there are all these people who have great initiatives in companies, great initiatives of their own, you know, startups, causes, social causes that they're trying to promote, art that they're trying to put out into the world. And they've struggled so much to get their ideas out, while the people who are, as I said, not doing great work are better at hyping things up. And so, yeah, I've really been focused on teaching that in a variety of formats that reach a wider scale of people, and sort of arming people with the fishing pole instead of giving them the fish. So we just did our first workshop to a mass audience, not a mass audience, a general audience, all kinds of great people. One person who, a woman who runs a photography business for like natural birth, you know, things, someone working on a TV script, someone doing a startup. And I'll tell you, the level of like appreciation and actually implementation, these people went out and did the work, you know, they went out there and you could see the change being affected. And that was so gratifying. So yeah, I'm really pushing hard to do, you know, keynote talks on it, workshops, in-house workshops, digital workshops. That's I've been convinced that these ideas are in a world where the bad guys so often get one over on us. I've kind of become a convert of my own magic sauce. So that's, so we're still doing the agency work and we always will, but this has become that mass audience piece has really become a bigger part of our business.
Nice. And yeah, as you were talking about that and talking about, you know, and starting with consultants and things like that, it made me think. I'm a big fan of Seth Godin. I've taken a lot of his Akimbo workshops and I have his voice in my head all the time. And there was something I learned from him that really made a huge difference in how I approach not just marketing, but business in general and kind of life, really. And it's the concept of having a minimal viable audience, where you don't really have to appeal to everyone.
Yeah.
You don't have to be for everyone. And so what is the minimal viable audience that you really need to be successful, at least at first? And then with the idea of that comes word of mouth and the idea virus, you know, his book about how ideas spread, that now that minimal viable audience will start to tell, you know, more people and it will grow. Do you think that one of the biggest hurdles people have in shifting their mindset to more of a hype focused mindset is that they're afraid of not pleasing everyone and that they don't understand the minimal viable audience concept?
Not even a question, you know, I mean, on many levels. I mean, first of all, my company is called Micro Fame Media. I mean, to me, the whole concept is that it's funny, if you look up Microfame, there's like a New York Times article about the concept and us, because we were pretty early in talking about that. And it's this concept that in the modern era, and this is such a blessing for business people, you don't need to be famous. You need to be micro famous. And people do, they know that in theory, but they don't practice it. You know, I'll work with clients and have these difficult conversations. I usually get through to them where they'll say to me, you know, I really want to have a contrarian point of view. I really want to do. And then when I push them to actually do that, they'll be, yeah, but we have potential buyers in the banking industry who would really get offended by that. And I'd be like, how many banking clients do you have? None. I'm like, well, but we could, you know? And I'm like, okay. I, in other words, like, yeah, everyone wants to like be loved by everyone, but then you have a very middle of the road milquetoast message that's usually liked by no one.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And we're in such a great position. I mean, in the age of mass media, there was something to that. You know, Johnny Carson was a really likable guy and really, you know, had a little bit of an edge, but not really. Or Lawrence Welk. My grandma used to watch Lawrence Welk, this like really like boring, like clarinet music that was like so popular because it like offended nobody. But now I have a 10-year-old daughter and she knows no movie stars. She knows like really? YouTube video game influencers.
Wow.
That you probably don't know.
Yeah. I'll get there in about 10 years when my,
right.
my sons get older, but yeah.
Well, they'll be different. Or crazy. he might be into paleontology influencers. In other words, we're just not in this monoculture. And I've seen Seth Godin talk about that. And I think it's really smart. He said, I saw him on stage and he was the star of the thing. It was like he was Elvis at this convention. And he's like, all of you people know who I am and you're all fans. He's like, I assure you that if I walked out on the street, 99% of the people wouldn't have any idea who I was. But this 1% pays me a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's millions of people.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff. Really appreciate you coming on to talk about this. Fascinating subject. You know, a couple of my favorite topics, marketing, psychology, they go hand in hand. Yeah, great book.
Thank really, you. That really means a lot. Book. Thank you.
Loved reading it. So
really means a lot.
So yeah, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure. I enjoyed this a whole lot.
That wraps up our first ever episode of Marketing Unboxed. If you enjoyed it, please tell a friend, a fellow marketer, anyone who you think would like listening, and please subscribe. We're going to continue to build this thing. We're just getting started, and it's going to be fun. So subscribe. Hit us up if you have any questions. You can reach out to me at travis@raineerdigital.com. That's RAINIER digital.com. I'm out.